Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. It's a big topic, but it's a very human topic. So close your eyes for a second and picture a scene. Your friend Susan is a 35-year-old lady, and she's just had a devastating phone call. Her older sister has just been diagnosed with breast cancer. They caught it early, so her chances are good. At first, all Susan can think about is her sister. But as the days go by, she starts to think about herself. How does this change her own chances of getting cancer? Is she going to get this too? Picture a second scene. You're on the sofa, watching TV. It's a thriller, and the detective is closing in on the suspect. She confronts him, and they speak. She offers him a cup of coffee. Later, she whizzes over to the lab, swabs the cup, and hands it in for DNA analysis. And you think, wow, can she do that? What's the science? What's the law? Part of what we do at Genomics England is spend a lot of time with our patients and participants really understanding what they need and what's important to them. And that's why we get out of bed in the morning. We're trying to help make a difference in their lives. And in 2021, we really want to open up that dialogue. Genomics is coming into the mainstream of healthcare and many other domains. And we believe passionately that we all need to talk more about it and that we at Genomics England need to be all ears in listening to different perspectives. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, other responses. And there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Genomics is fascinating to me because the science is moving so fast. The technology is right at the cutting edge of what machines can do, whether that's computers, DNA sequences, or wet blood chemistry. But most of all, it's fascinating because of the impact on people's lives, the human stories that we get involved in, and the fact that our work helps make sure that more and more of those stories have happy endings. The UK, of course, has a proud history here, from Charles Darwin to Rosalind Franklin, who used X-ray crystallography to discover the structure of DNA, to Crick and Watson, who modelled that structure so beautifully, to Fred Sanger, who transformed DNA sequencing, and many more individuals, teams, and institutions. But so many of us are unaware of the possibilities of genomic medicine and the potential impact, and I deeply believe that everyone should be involved in making those decisions as genomics comes into the mainstream. So I'm going to be trying to explain some of the concepts and increase people's understanding and interest in this. I'm going to be hearing from some people whose lives have been changed by genomics, talking to some of the leading researchers in the field, hopefully dispelling some myths and misunderstandings, and really listening and discussing the ethical, scientific, and practical challenges in this field. I also hope that I'm going to be learning a lot, that I'll be stimulating debate and opening channels for people to express their views, because talking and listening breeds understanding. We'll be talking with some amazing people, from global leaders in the field to community leaders, ethicists, policymakers, religious leaders, and of course to the patients and the research participants for whom we do this work. In the coming weeks, I'll be talking to Matt Hancock, the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, Dame Sally Davies, the former Chief Medical Officer, whose 2016 report, Generation Genome, set the tone for the UK's endeavours here, Gillian Hastings Ward, who's a leading campaigner and a representative of folks who've participated in genomics research, Eric Topple of the Topple Review fame and digital health in the NHS, about how genomics is transforming medicine, and many, many more. But critically, I want to hear from you. My DMs are open on Twitter, it's @Chris_Wigley, or you can email podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. In the meantime, sit back, pour a cup of tea, slip on your headphones, take the dog for a walk, do what you do. At the risk of stealing with pride from Lord Reith's mission statement for the BBC, we aim to inform, educate, and entertain. Welcome to the G Word. So it is my great pleasure to be joined on the podcast today with Eric Topple, who is a globally recognised physician and author. He's among the top 10 cited medical researchers in the world. He's the founder and director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute. He's a big futurist with an eye on what's coming next, trying to shift the healthcare paradigm for the patient. And Eric, you're someone who wrote your thesis on the prospects for genetic therapy in man in 1975. So this is a topic that you've been thinking about for some time. Extremely excited to discuss these prospects and where we see them going from 2020 with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, gosh, Chris, thanks so much, and great to be with you, and look forward to our discussion today.
We're going to explore a few elements of how genomics fits into digital health and some of the implications that that has for patients, for the public, and so on. But I'd love to start, if we can, with take us back to 1975, and what was genetics looking like then?
Yes, well, that was when I was back in the good old days of being in a university, and I was so excited about genetics, and that was just the beginning of the whole idea of recombinant technology and the ethics of the potential for gene therapy, which took 40 more years. Who would ever thought it would take that long? But I do still think that genomics is the most exciting advance in our lifetime. It's been capped off more recently by the ability to edit the genome, and the gene therapy has been starting to get actualized. But, you know, there's been many other things that have happened in life science, but I don't know that anything is so extraordinary as that.
It's a pretty transformational. And you've had a celebrated career since then, but for people not in the field, just give us a sense of how you filled your time between 1975 and 2020.
Well, I did think about, you know, just spending the rest of my life in genetics, but I got turned on to the idea of patient contact. I had a part-time job while I was in school in a hospital night shift, and I saw patients that were seemingly resurrected in the intensive care unit as a respiratory technician. So I said, well, I better go to medical school. And so it took me a while to get back to the area that I loved the most. It really wasn't until after I left University of Michigan, my first faculty job, where I went to Cleveland Clinic, and we eventually in the 90s started the first cardiovascular gene bank, where we consecutively enrolled 10,000 people with heart disease and got their DNA and started to do some, you know, really, some state-of-the-art genomics. But obviously now that looks like anemic stuff.
I was going to say, I mean, 10,000, there was a lot more work involved in getting any kind of sequencing done then, right? Just bring that to life for us a bit. Like, what does sequencing 10,000 people look like in the 90s?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, we were just lucky to get one single nucleotide polymorphism. You know, thinking of a sequence was a fantasy land. So, you know, the idea of being able to do a very limited assessment of a panel of SNPs was kind of, that was about as good as it got in the late 90s. So, you know, when in 2000, that historic day, which actually was on my birthday.
Oh, wow.
Kind of funny, June 26th. Yeah. When Francis Collins and Craig Venter and Bill Clinton did this mission accomplished dance in the Rose Garden at the White House. You know, I think obviously it was premature to make such strong proclamations, but it was a turning point that, as you're getting to, Chris, that the sequencing era was really beginning. We had a draft human sequence, which got annotated much more over the next few years. But it was the beginning of getting sequencing to scale, which has happened, you know, much more recent times. And that, of course, has led to the worldwide leader, where you are in the UK, in genomics. I mean, that's one of the things that in my review of the NHS that was done a year and a half ago, it was very clear to me that you're so far ahead of the rest of the world in the genetics, genomics space that it's laudable. But, you know, if you look back, it was really, it had its roots, you know, decades before, and especially, you know, when sequencing could be done at a relatively small price with high accuracy and definition resolution. So, you know, I think we're still building on this. When we look back, they're not me, but when somebody looks back, they'll say even 2020 was still early in this era.
Yeah.
You know, I think we have to keep perspective that it moves much more slowly than we feel it's moving. You know, we think it's just rocking. And it isn't really. It should go much faster than this.
It's a great point. And I think it's that transition from genomics as something which is really driving forward understanding in the research sphere through into how do we actually get it into the mainstream of medicine, right? So that it's actually relevant to patients and increasing diagnostic rates and improving treatments and outcomes and so on. And it feels like we're starting to get to a tipping point there. But I think, as you say, it's easy to have the grand vision and actually translating that into the day-to-day work of hundreds of thousands of physicians is a huge challenge. In terms of that prospect, almost to go back to the title of your thesis, how do you see that playing out? You know, genetics being relevant in the clinic. You know, what's your sense on the state of the art?
Well, it's starting to really take hold in a few areas. Eventually, it'll be pervasive, and we won't even use the term genomic medicine because it will be medicine.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, you're seeing it. Obviously, it's had a very big impact already in the cancer space with respect to helping to get a definition of a person's cancer, which is obviously unique to each individual as far as implementing therapy and understanding what their prognosis might be, even identifying, you know, what is the type of cancer, but also and tracking it potentially with liquid biopsy from, you know, a single tube of blood. But in addition to that, it's completely transformed prenatal assessment. I mean, the idea that you could get fetal DNA from a maternal sample and determine chromosomal abnormalities and more, which has basically almost eliminated the need for amniocentesis, and in some parts of the world, you know, really having striking reduction of major chromosomal abnormalities, and at the least, getting parents ready for what is going to happen, you know, at the time of birth. So you're in certain areas like unknown diseases, pathogen genomics. Oh my goodness, has that changed the way we map an outbreak and the way we understand the COVID pandemic? So certain areas that just light up, that genomics has just totally revamped our approach. And then many others that are still kind of waiting. They're just, you know, they're kind of, you know, medicine is a sclerotic, ossified type of community. It doesn't change quickly. It takes a lot of momentum, you know, and push to finally get it to move.
And so to a large extent, I guess cancer is, you know, a disease of the genome, right? So like big relevance in cancer, we're talking about kind of rare diseases. And as you mentioned, a huge role in the response to COVID this year, which I'd love to come back to. What's your sense of what it takes to get genomics informing and, I guess, relevant to common diseases like heart conditions or obesity, diabetes? You know, how do we bring it into those much more common conditions?
Well, I do think that polygenic risk scores have tremendous utility. There still is debate about this, but at least as far as I'm concerned, they provide some insight. So every time they're looked at for the main conditions in which they've been validated, they show the risk that is added to, independent from, the known clinical risk factors. So, for example, for heart disease, you know, we know things like smoking and diabetes, high cholesterol are associated with risk. But now we know the polygenic risk score from hundreds of common SNPs is very indicative. Particularly, it's important when it's high. So I use it in all patients that I see in helping to deliberate whether we should start a statin medication so we don't treat people unnecessarily. But the same would hold for type 2 diabetes, for the risk of atrial fibrillation, you know, many conditions, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer. We don't use, this is a theme, Chris, we don't use the data that we know, it sits in the research orbit in these wonderful papers that are frequently cited and, you know, very highly regarded, and it isn't transformed to clinical practice. And the resistance to not use the polygenic risk scores is just befuddling to me, because it helps patients. And what we have is a paternalistic medical community that thinks, oh, well, we shouldn't tell the patients their give their genomic data. This is the U.S. I know it's not quite as bad, or maybe not at all, so much in the U.K. or other countries. But here we have this continual debate that the patient can't handle it.
Right.
You know, they can't handle the truth. That is just ridiculous. And it gets me infuriated because, you know, all you have to do is ask the patient whether they want the information, and with the caveats that some of it is fuzzy and some of it is just, you know, totally uncertain, but some of it we do know. So, you know, I continually am surprised that we don't take the data, the knowledge, and give it to patients and make it useful on a clinical, medical basis.
It's a huge area, isn't it? It's I'm reminded immediately of that sort of Jack Nicholson quote from "You can't handle the truth," right? It's like, we need to get some t-shirts printed up with that on it. But I think there's a big kind of science communication question there, right? How do we? Because exactly as you said, some things we know for sure. Some things mean that we're pretty sure that this changes the odds of something happening, and some bits, as you said, are fuzzy. And you know, it strikes me that in order to empower patients in that way, we also as a community have to find better ways of communicating these different types of certainty and uncertainty and so on, so that we're not effectively misleading people. Or giving them information which gets them to jump to false conclusions. Like, do you have any thoughts about how we can, as a community, kind of get better at communicating this stuff?
Well, first we should communicate instead of keep it compartmentalize it. Secondly, I do think that most people will understand very well, you say, even the things that we think are certain could be revised. We've seen that.
Yeah.
So what we want to do is respond to what you want. What level of information would you like? None? Oh, okay, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Would you like things that we feel are relatively confident about? But I think the science of genomics has to be conveyed, which is it's continually reassessed. It requires replication, triplication, validation to the hilt. And there's still so much we don't know. I mean, we talk about whole genome sequencing as if it's whole genome, and there's still parts of the genome that are dark to us that we still don't even know. So, you know, if we communicate humbly with humility to patients and cater to their interests, because they're all different. Some people want to know everything. They're just data hoards. They don't know what they'll do with it, but they want it all. And some people, they want nothing to do with it. And that's okay, too. I respect their whims and interests, and I think it's their right. It's their data, not ours.
Well,
it's their data.
That's such an important point, right? And it's really struck me just in the year that I've been at Genomics England, the strength of feeling on this topic. You used the word paternalistic a minute ago, and it really strikes me that what we have to do is have a peer-to-peer or kind of adult-to-adult conversation about these topics, right? And I've been accosted a couple of times by campaigning folks of one flavor or another who are saying, what you're doing is immoral and it should be illegal and you're abusing these poor people and taking their data and selling it and so on. And I say, look, I understand that you're coming at this from good intentions, but you are 100% wrong. And if you think that the people who take part in these research studies don't know what they're doing, you need to go and talk to them. Because if you have a rare disease or cancer or your kid does, wow, very quickly you are the world expert on that topic, right? And it's been incredibly eye-opening for me how active and empowered a lot of people are. I mean, this I find almost terrifying, but maybe this is just because I'm old-fashioned. But I mean, we see in some of the patient community things like Facebook groups, people swapping, you know, their BAM files, right? Which for those not in the field is kind of the raw file of your whole genome, saying, have a look at this, see what you think, you know. And it's in many ways it's amazing, right? This is creating these kind of empowered communities, but it's still, I think, pretty niche. And your point about we need to find that way to have a conversation with every patient, I think, is an incredibly powerful push.
You're highlighting a really critical point, Chris, in that in the world today, patients trust their peers, patient peers more than they do their doctors in many cases. That is, they like to get information from those who they believe are more their level, their true peer group. And certainly in the U.S., what we've seen is that things that are disseminated like that, as you just described, it enables and establishes more trust than when it comes down from the mountain of the of the medical world.
The golden tablets. Yeah, right?
So I think we should respect that too. That is, there's no better vector of getting genomics into the mainstream of putting it out there so that it just spreads and enables the people to realize that we're in this now. We're all in this. And you know, it's suitable for everyone. So that is a very important but neglected area of getting this bridge to a different time when genomics and medicine is fully accepted.
And it's, you used the phrase there, we're all in this. And I think in 2020, you know, the year of COVID, the impact that, you know, disease can have on the community and that we can have on each other in that context is huge. Of course, with genomics, there are these incredibly strong family links. You know, often when we're looking at a sick patient, we'll also look at the genomes of their mother and father to understand what's going on. People who are cousins, even second cousins, have these relationships come up in the DNA data, and there've been these well publicized cases of sort of the police or intelligence services being able to use publicly accessible data sets to try and identify people and so on. There's something inherently identifiable about the whole genome in the same way that there is about like our fingerprints or whatever. How can we think about privacy and data privacy in this context? You know, there are some people who say we just live in a post-privacy world, get over it. There are other people who say actually data privacy is the most important thing around and we need to protect it. You know, what's your take on this incredibly complex topic?
Yeah, it is very complex. And, you know, neither of those two polls that you just reviewed are necessarily right. I do lean more on that it's precious data that we should keep as private as possible and secure. However, it may not be fully possible. We have to acknowledge that re-identification of a person's genomic data will be possible. What we want to do is try to minimize the chances of that to the greatest degree. So we have new tools to do that, tools like homomorphic encryption, and things that we can do to make it extremely difficult for genomic data for any individual to be essentially used to establish their identity. And we should use those tools more rather than the notion that, oh, so what? Because there are going to be things about a person's genome, no less their family, who might not even know that the one individual has their genomic data out, and all of a sudden there's a bunch of people that have basically had their cover blown about some important variant, rare variant, disease, whatever, risk. So, you know, I think this is something that we should work aggressively to try to preserve, acknowledging it won't be perfect, but as close as we can get it.
And you mentioned encryption and kind of protection of the data sources. Obviously, for a lot of the research, having larger data sets makes the research more powerful because it's more statistically powered. Where do you think we are, or where do you think we're going in terms of finding ways at a sort of infrastructure level to be able to share some of these data sets in an appropriate way where privacy and ethics can be maintained?
The other thing that I would like to see, you know, this has been a fantasy for a while, is the planetary health resource. I know that sounds very far-fetched.
It sounds great. Say more.
I mean, what I think is, if we had, you know, 7 or 8 billion genomes, and I do want to get into that, it's not just the genome, of course, but we had the health data for as many people as we could on the planet. You know, Kai-Fu Lee and I wrote a paper called "It Takes a Planet." and it was Nature Biotech over a year ago. But the idea, the notion was, with federated AI and these new encryption tools, that we don't have to take the data from any place, but we just need to basically work on it, develop the algorithms locally at the edge, and bring it together. And we could have a resource whereby, you know, let's say if you were sick, Chris, you had a new diagnosis of an important illness, but we didn't know what the right treatment is, and we did nearest neighbor analysis and found 8 digital twins of you. And then we had your treatment and outcomes iced, rather than a clinical trial where, you know, 15% reduction, where most of the people have nothing to do with you, if not all. We could actually be really, really precise about finding people that resemble you the most at every level, not just their genome, but, you know, your data from your electronic health record, your environment, your other biologic layers, your physiome, your anatome, I mean, everything. So that's my dream for the future. We could do this. We could do this. But we have to get over this nationalism. We have to get over, you know, all the kind of tension between. Interestingly, you know, I wrote that with a prominent Chinese scientist. So if we could get the U.S., China, and the U.K. to work together, we could do this. You know, that would be really exciting.
It's huge. And as they say in the $6 million Man, you know, we have the technology, right? It's sort of, you know, it's been perfected through things like online shopping. You know, those kind of lookalike models are very much, you know, applicable in this field, aren't they? And so you mentioned, of course, that the genome only tells part of the story, right? There's, we learn in high school, kind of, DNA encrypts RNA, which makes proteins and so on. So there's that kind of causal chain of biology. There's also things like imagery and scans and so on, and wearables. You know, how can we think about bringing all of this Cambrian explosion of data to bear on an individual case?
Yeah, that's also a big part of the future. So we know the notion that the genome had our operating instructions was naive, actually, you know, in retrospect. But what we do know, obviously, is quite important. But then we want to do, you know, RNA-seq. The problem is, of course, that so much of the information, the epigenome and the regulatory genome, is at the tissue and cell level. It's quite unique. So we can't get that all, you know, for every person's cells and tissues and all that data. So what we can get is not just a mRNA assessment, a protein assessment. Obviously, the gut microbiome carries tremendous amount of information, and it's relatively stable over the course of a person's adult life. Then there's, you know, we have sensors now, as you've mentioned, not just for the person's physiology, but also for the environment. So all these different layers, and here's what's exciting. When you have all this data per, big data per individual, and it's continually processed with not just deep learning, but also other hybrid models, you could actually take a person who is at high risk for a particular condition, and through the data, getting back to them, basically coach them so they never have the condition that they were predisposed to. And that's where big data per individual, which, you know, obviously genomics will play a significant role, but we finally have to acknowledge that it's only one layer of a multi-layered story. And this eventually will be the virtual health assistant for people who want to use it. I mean, some people will say, you know, I have no interest in that. You know, I'll take my fate as whatever, but for many who respect the value of knowledge and information, they may
want
that.
And it's fascinating, as you said, how this changes over time, right? Over the course of someone's life. And I love this idea of having almost a subscription model. And it's interesting to see there are some startups now in the States that are not just offering to sequence your genome and give you a readout for like $1,000 or whatever, but saying actually, subscribe and we'll give you an annual readout, because we're gonna go back because the literature is moving so fast and so on, and as these new things come on stream, we'll tell you. And obviously we're a government company in the UK. We're closely working with the NHS, and I think there's an extraordinary kind of mental model where this becomes a kind of lifetime subscription. You know, on a on a much more trivial level, I subscribe to kind of Apple Music and Spotify, right? And I'm sharing data with those services about what music I'm listening to. And they, in return, you mentioned this personal digital assistant, right, are saying, oh, you might like this song. And actually, it works really well. I'm like, oh, where has this song been all my life? But that's at a reasonably trivial level, right? Whereas if we get to a point where you think about having a lifetime subscription where you are sharing your health data, which is much more sensitive, with a trusted organization like the NHS, and in return, you're getting personalized guidance about how to live your best life or how to be, as well and as healthy as you can be. And as you say, avoid things that you might otherwise have, problems you might otherwise have encountered. That becomes a pretty compelling pitch. I think at least in UK, that's like, well done. By being a citizen of the UK, you get a free lifelong subscription to the NHS, right? Or free at the point of consumption. But I think it's an interesting model for other health systems as well. Is that something that you could see, happening in the next, I don't know what the difference between 1975 and 2020 is, but like over that period of time?
Oh, I that is going to happen. I mean, we're not the capabilities to do it. I mean, we're already seeing that, for isolated conditions like type 2 diabetes, and soon enough it'll be on a much more holistic level. We can do this. It's just a matter of, how long does it take to get built and validated and broadly accepted? But, there's no excuse that we don't go after this because, we talk so much about prevention, so much, and we don't ever do it. And part of it is we just didn't have the tools to really do that. But there's so many conditions that are eminently preventable, and whether that's obviously heart disease and things like asthma and, there's a long list of conditions that people shouldn't have to live through if we just use the knowledge that we already have and get that back to the person, in terms of coaching and helping them actualize that.
And
potential.
There's a huge question, though. We've talked about these incredibly rich data models, personalized medicine, the new tools that are coming in, deploying the knowledge that we have. To some extent, there's this phrase that people use, about real life experience. They don't teach that in business school. In this context, to some extent, they don't teach that in medical school, right? So, like, how do we almost kind of retrofit this whole profession with this kind of both the knowledge and skills to actually deploy this kind of medicine in the field?
Yeah, that's a really important point, Chris, and a few things on that. First of all, that was one of the other things I really noted about the NHS in my dwell time there, was there was this Health Education England, and they were responsible for getting the workforce, oriented and educated, and that is something that's unique. We have nothing like that here in the U.S., or as far as I know, almost anywhere else in the world. So the HEE that you have is really impressive. Now, we do need every clinician, every doctor, and even more broadly, to get some kind of genomic certification. Quick sort of get the basics, because the buy-in and the reason why we haven't made more progress is because a lot of people just are afraid of it. They're just afraid to learn this, It reminds me, back in the days when the stethoscope was invented, it took 20 years before it was accepted. This is the icon of medicine, right? It took 20 years. And why did it take 20 years? Because the doctors didn't want to learn about these sounds that came from patients. They didn't want to learn about the sound. And that's kind of what we have now. We have decades of not willing to move into the genomics space because people don't want to learn. And, the old dogs, no one has that in their medical school training from, my era. But even so today, the limited curriculum in medical schools in the United States, it's just pitiful. Because I think, and I've written, that every student should sequence themselves and learn about bioinformatics, learn about their genome. And if there's some reason they don't want to sequence themselves, sequence somebody. But that's how it should be taught. And, this is something that is so easily done. It's so inexpensive relative to the cost of medical school here. I just think we don't make these moves that we should be doing. We don't push on.
That's huge. Like I love the idea of each medical student sequencing themselves. And I'm trying to think what the visual equivalent, you mentioned the stethoscope, and now every photo of a physician, they have like a stethoscope kind of slung around their neck, right? Like to, as the sort of proof of, you know, expertise and clinical credibility. We almost need the sort of like LAN cable or something. We need a digital equivalent of that that people can use as a status symbol to get them on board. We mentioned earlier about patients and data and choice and having kind of adult conversations. How do you think that we can bring patients and clinicians on this journey together? Because there was this conversation probably about 10 or 15 years ago when patients started effectively kind of Googling their condition before they went in to see the doctor, and the doctors were saying, wow, you know, this is ridiculous. All these patients are looking this up online and then coming in and trying to tell me how to do my job. You know, when we're thinking about these emerging technologies that are so new and moving so fast, how can we bring patients and doctors on that journey together?
Yeah, well, I think we have to have the doctors stand up. You know, it's kind of like now that we're in the vaccine era, if doctors all had a picture of themselves getting a shot, which I've been advocating for, and spread that around, that'll help the patients want to get it as well, or, you know, the not patients, but the public. The same sort of thing. If doctors were more into this, you see, right now we unfortunately have this bottoms-up approach whereby people are getting their genomic data, whether it's through a 1 million SNP chip or whether it's through an exome or whatever. They're getting some genomic data, and they're going to the doctor, and they're saying, well, what do I do? Yeah. This is in the U.S. Yeah. Yeah. And the doctor says, I don't know. I don't. Why are you bringing this to me? You know, I don't get paid to help interpret your data.
Why do I care if you like cilantro or not? You know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we have this reverse. It should be the other way around, which is, you know, we have physicians promoting the use, and whether it's because they did their own genomics and learned something and prevented an illness, or that it's helped other patients. You know, that sort of thing. But the lesion, the block here is that we don't have the buy-in yet broadly from the medical community, even among oncologists, who you would think would, as you said in the outset, it's a genomic disease. Many still have a limited acceptance of point mutations for, you know, they don't accept that you can follow a person's cancer through serial liquid biopsies, for example. And here we are, we're just about at the cusp of being able to diagnose cancer in people at increased genomic risk and family history risk before they ever had cancer, microscopically.
Yep.
And so we're at this exciting juncture. We still don't even have, you know, oncologists advocating this. It's actually, you know, to me, extraordinary that even the people that are have the deepest connect with genomics in their medical practice have not even fully valued how important it is to get as much data as possible to help manage their patients.
It's a big paradigm shift, I guess, right? And you mentioned earlier this idea of having effectively a personal digital assistant to kind of guide you through choices and issues that come up over the course of your life. Like, bring that to life a little bit for us. Like, what could that look like?
Well, I do think we you know, in the book I did on deep medicine, I gave that a whole chapter on this virtual medical coach. And it takes all these layers of data about you continually getting in real time process. It also takes all the medical literature about you relevant to the moment. And it basically is giving you, attuned to your specifications. It's giving you advice. So, you know, just like today you have smart speakers to Alexa or whoever you're talking to, in the future you'd have, you know, somebody talking to you, or if you prefer an avatar on your phone, or if you prefer a text, or however way you want to get it, you would get, you know, this is this food that you're eating right now is not going to help prevent your type 2 diabetes. Now, you say, I gave examples of this, but you say, I'm firing that coach because I don't like this.
I want to eat a steak, goddammit.
Yeah. So you see, you know, we're going to have this almost like a digital conscience algorithm, if you want, to prevent conditions. And it'll help. It won't help. It won't, you know, people still will do what they want. But the point is that the ability to take all this data about any given individual and feed it back to them is possible. It's not, we're not quite there yet on a whole person's medical basis. That is, we right now can just do that for type 2 diabetes and a couple, maybe high blood pressure, but we're going to get there. It's I've talked to, you know, all the colleagues in the AI you know, gurus who believe that, you know, we can hybrid models, not just what we know today, but, you know, the ones that are going to be developed and achieve this in the next few years. So I'm excited about that, and I can't wait to have a virtual medical coach to help me. But I totally respect that a lot of people think it's ridiculous and they won't, don't want any part of it. But let's just see how.
But I think that's a great theme, and this has come up a couple of times in different contexts in our conversation so far. When you were saying, you know, some people will love it, some people might hate it and want nothing to do with it, you know, and that's fine. I think that's a really important point for us to kind of land with both the community and also with, you know, patients and the wider public, right? That this has to come down to choice. That none of these technologies, none of these opportunities, these options are things that anyone is going to mandate, but they're there as things for you to choose to do on it in a sort of informed way.
I also would say the difference here is a noteworthy one, Chris, is that what we have today is the analog world of medicine. People go in to see their doctor on a one-off basis. They get an assessment of whatever it is that moment in time, you know, whether it's their blood pressure or their status. They get a lab test one moment in time. We can do so much better than that with sensors and, you know, a person's real world where they go to work or they go to whatever they're doing. There's all these different physiologic factors and triggers, you know, in their home environment. And that provides continuous data to supplement these rarefied one-off visits with a medical personnel. So the point I'm trying to get at is if we move into the digital era where we take all the, it's just like, you know, the genome sequence is a static single part of our story. I mean, obviously that's why things like RNA-seq is going to be much more dynamic. You know, one's like the rest, and the other is the stress test. So what we want is a continual assessment in a dynamic real world. And that's how we understand people so much better than just thinking, oh, because we have their operating instructions, we understand everything.
I mean, I have an almost absurd example of that from when I was a teenager that I used to have asthma. And it turned out later that this was triggered by cat hairs or whatever, and we had a cat when I was a teenager. That was the problem. But I went, I'd had my Ventolin kind of asthma inhaler, and then went into the doctor to get a repeat prescription, and they said, oh, it's been a year or something, you should do that, the blow test. And so I did the kind of, I can't remember the word for it now, that sort of lung flow test. And because I'd had my Ventolin, I was fine. I had, like, I'd used to play the flute, and so I had good, strong lungs. And the doctor said, oh, that's great. You don't have asthma. And I was like, even as a teenager, I was like, well, hold on. I don't have asthma now, like right now in your office. But believe me, I do have asthma as soon as I go home. And of course, we realized later it was the cat, right? But like, that's just, you're exactly right. We look at one moment in time and just extrapolate and say, right, okay, that's it, right? Whereas compared to something like, you know,
you could have been on inhalers and steroids and all these medicines for the whole life because of not knowing what was actually going on in your real world.
Exactly.
And that's the problem. You know, we don't have enough respect for the importance of that person's environment and the limited window. It's almost like an ice pick view we have of them when we see them in a medical context.
It's so true. And I was reflecting on that. Now I'm walking around with a clinical grade ECG machine on my wrist, you know, which is is monitoring me the whole time. And in fact, what it's just done is pop up and say, almost there, keep moving for 1 minute to make progress towards your stand goal today. So, you know, the personal medical coach is, at least the level one of personal medical coach is already there, is telling me to stand up.
Yeah, I would say it's level zero, but we'll get there.
Let's say level zero. But I think the future one will definitely need a mute button. You know, I think pre-pandemic, if I was on a long-haul flight, I would get really annoyed with the constant reminders to stand up or to try and hit my move goal. I said, come on, I'm flying. You know, do you not give me a break? You know, just it's and then it would pop up and say, take a moment to deep breathe.
That the algorithm of the future would know you're flying.
Yeah,
you wouldn't have to tell it, yeah. Because it knew that you just went into a plane, and you know that your plane made it to your plane on time. And it's not just factoring in your medical data; it's factoring in, you know, what you're doing on any given day or time.
Completely.
Yeah.
One final, very practical question: you're someone who has achieved enough in your career to fill kind of multiple high-profile careers. You've had 3 best-selling books. You're showing no signs of letting up. 2 questions, in fact, I'll cheat. One is, when do you sleep? And the second is, when if ever, do you feel like you can say, right, I've achieved something here. You know, I'm done.
Wow. Well, you're very and too kind, Chris. Really. I don't think that it's all that much to really talk or write about. But what I would say is that I'm not sleeping well, you know, with this pandemic. And the reason is I'm on edge because of how brutally mismanaged, you know, how colossal a catastrophe it's been here in the U.S. I know there's some that you share some of that in the U.K., but here we have had the most pathetic leadership. And it's hard for me to get a rest because I basically shifted a lot of attention to this COVID scene because it's so atrocious. And I'm glad, of course, that the science is helping providing a path out of it. It's going to take some time. But normally, you know, for me, it's just trying to help put things together. You know, when you get older, like I am, it's easier to see the future a bit more because you've had so many years of experience.
You can extrapolate better.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I couldn't have a better idea about where we might be headed if it didn't take me 45 years to see gene therapy finally click. So, you know, that perspective is what helps me. It's a sleepless perspective some days, but, you know, it's like, we will look back at this pandemic and we will remember some of the worst and best parts of it. We'll get through it. But during it, it's been for me, especially tense and probably the most anxious time of my life.
It's been an extraordinary roller coaster of a year, hasn't it? Across tragedy and farce and all of the emotions. But I think it's also, we've reflected on a lot as a community in the UK. In adversity, a lot of incredible progress has been made scientifically and also in the application of that science kind of in the lab, you know, machine learning algorithms to predict severity of response, you know, the genomics of the virus itself, the genomics of the humans involved, you know, standing up these entire testing industries from scratch. It's, as we're reflecting on it, it's been definitely a year for the history books for all of the reasons, good and bad, I think. On which maybe somewhat somber note we should leave it. But Eric, I want to say a huge thank you for making the time today. Hugely inspirational discussion, and I'm looking forward to my level 3 health coach.
Well, let me say, Chris, I really enjoyed our conversation even more than I had envisioned. It was fun, and also you know, congratulations to you and what you're doing with Genomics England. It's in the world view, and you're clearly, with your efforts, UK Biobank, and all the things that preceded it and are ongoing, you're showing the world where genomics is and where it can go. And so we'll continue to watch and learn from you. And I'm envious. That's all I can say. I'm highly envious. And someday maybe the US will try to catch up.
Well, it's your turn to be too kind. But really appreciate it. You know, all any of us can do is keep plowing on, right? Really appreciate the time and great chatting with you. Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society.
Remember to subscribe to The G-Word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series, and appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G-Word.